You can hear the traffic noises behind me. I'm afraid you can. You'll know that I'm not in Pine Ridge. I'm in New York, and my guest today is from Pine Ridge, sort of, because his name was Lum, and is really Mr. Chester Lauk, now of Houston, Texas. Is that right?
That is correct.
Pine Ridge, was that the name of it?
That was the name of our mythical little town.
Did you ever name the state?
Yes. We didn't in the beginning, but we were so thoroughly identified with Arkansas, we finally started calling it Pine Ridge, Arkansas.
That is where you're from, is it not?
Well, we're from a little town of Mena, Arkansas. We used Pine Ridge because it depicted a mountainous section, pine forest.
Was there really a Pine Ridge?
There wasn't in the beginning. Later, a little town down in Arkansas changed its name. It takes an act of Congress to do this, hoping to capitalize on what publicity we were giving. Apparently, it didn't work out very well because I think the town's still the same size now as it was then.
But it's still Pine Ridge.
Right.
And did they start a jot-em-down store?
Oh, yes, there's a jot-em-down store there, and Dick Huddleston's store, and Moe's Moose Barber Shop. They've named all their little...
I was just kidding when I asked you that. They went that far?
Yes, they did.
I wonder what kind of business the jot-em-down store...
They got a lot of visitors in there.
But still,
the town hasn't grown.
How long have you been off the air now?
11 years.
Do you miss it?
No, really, I don't. I'm so busy. I'm with Continental Oil Company now, out of Houston. And I attend a lot of conventions on behalf of the company and do a lot of after-dinner speaking. And I'm just so busy. And, of course, that is a form of the entertainment business, entertaining audiences.
Well, it is, but how did you get into the oil business?
Well,
running a jot-em-down store.
Someone asked me that not long ago, and I believe it was the president of our company that asked me that question.
Oh, I hope he was smiling when he asked you that.
Well, I had always wondered, even when I was doing radio, I had a yen to be in the oil business, and I had a little money to invest, and I was going to open an office and just handle royalties and just feel my way along. And then I decided maybe I should get with a major oil company and learn a little bit more about the business. And I made that connection, and I've been with them ever since. I never have gone into business for myself.
Well, now, Lum is in the oil business. Tell us what Mr. Goff is doing.
Mr. Goff is in the business of sitting. He's retired. He said he was awful fur behind any setting. And he lives right on the golf course in Palm Desert, California.
It's a nice place to live.
Oh, yeah.
Do you visit him?
Oh, yeah. We visit back and forth.
And he, does he miss it?
I don't think so. He's too busy playing golf to miss it.
Tell me about the jot-em-down store. How does it get that name? And what does it mean, anyway?
Well, we had a little contest. We were on the network for Ford Motor Company at the time, and rather than involve them in the thing, we just decided to have a little contest on our own. We offered a prize, and this was the name we selected. Jot 'em down.
Well, it stuck.
Yeah.
We
didn't realize at the time what an important part it was going to play in our program over a period of years. As a matter of fact, when we first started, we just took a leave of absence from our jobs. I was working in a bank, and my partner was associated with his father in the wholesale grocery business. I imagine he could have gotten his job back all right. But we had no idea that it was going to run for 24 years when we started it.
Is that how long you were on the network? 24 years?
We started in 1930, and we closed up the store in 1954.
Well, that, as I say, that name, Jot 'em Down, did stick because I was doing a remote. Well, all of my programs are remote, but this was the remotest remote I've done. Way up in the Catskills to see Mary Margaret McBride. And she said, gave me a lot of complicated directions. And she said, and then the last stop is at the little market. And she wanted me to pick something up. and you asked them where you find the McBride place. So we drove forever, it seemed to me. Finally we came out. I said, now there's little door. Now what did she say this store was called? He said, oh, I don't know. Up here it should be called the John Down store. This is what my friend said. There'd be no reference made to Lum and Abner, but that's part of Americana. Now, the Jot'em Down story. You made movies, too, as I recall.
Yeah, we made 10 pictures, although we never considered ourselves picture stars. We got in the picture business in the back door of the popularity of our radio show. And pictures were quite successful financially.
Did you have any qualms before you made them about sort of surprising or disappointing your audience, your radio audience, that is, about seeing you?
Yes, we did, because we realized that with radio, different people would have, different ones of our listeners would have a different impression of what Lum might look like or what Abner might look like. Some people might have thought Lum was a big fat fellow or a little short fellow, and Abner the opposite. I'm quite tall and my partner's quite short. So when we realized that we were going to start making pictures, our first picture, we thought we'd better give the audience some impression of what we really looked like. And we could do that through conversation, such as maybe Abner and Grandpappy Spears would be sitting in the store, and Abner would say, here comes old Lum, look at them big long legs of his, and that mustache blowing in the breeze. And that way we would impart the impression that Lum wore a mustache, that he was tall and lanky. Well, over a period of 2 or 3 months, we were able to
form an image.
You must have used a lot of terrible shock to them when they saw us.
You must have used a lot of makeup, because you're not an old man now.
Well, I have finally grown into the part, but of course at that time we started making pictures about 1939, I think. And we were much younger then, of course. And it was a problem that they have some makeup men in Hollywood that are great. It took about 2.5 hours in the makeup chair.
Every day. You're one of the only successful radio shows, and gosh knows you were very successful, not to make the transition into television.
Well, we didn't make the attempt even, because my partner had had an operation for cancer, and we knew the grind of making pictures, and we knew it would be even much harder in television, and because of his health, we didn't attempt it. Then, too, he was anxious to retire anyway.
One of the guest stars that I remember on your show, I guess she really wasn't a guest star, she was more or less a regular, was the late Zazu Pitt.
Yes, we made one series last about 2 years of 30-minute shows once a week. And there we had to use outside characters because we played before a studio audience and all. And we had Cliff Arquette and Zazu Pitts and Andy Devine.
Did you ever have Bob Burns?
No, I knew Bob quite well, but
he would have fit in very well. That was what he called the Arkansas Traveler.
Yeah,
wasn't he
would have been perfect.
Where was it he was supposedly from? He was always mentioned in that town.
Yeah, Van Buren.
Van Buren, Arkansas.
Yeah.
That was it. And he had a bazooka.
Yeah.
Very funny man. Very funny man. I knew Miss Pitts through her son, who I knew, actually I knew Miss Pitts better than I knew the son, but I met her through her son, who was the actually adopted son, who was the son of Barbara Lamar, who killed the girl who was so beautiful.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But you didn't remember that.
Well, I didn't know that.
Oh, you really? Really?
No.
Yes.
As well,
he was
Zazu,
adopted.
I didn't know that her adopted son was
As I recall, I'll probably get a letter correcting me on this, but I believe I'm right. Miss Lamar left 2 children. I think the other was a girl, and she was adopted by Cecil B. DeMille.
Well, I declare. That wasn't Catherine DeMille.
No.
still another daughter.
Yes, it was with an adopted daughter. I'm pretty sure I'm right on that. I know I am about to say the truth.
You know, you make these interviews so casual, I forget the times that we're actually being recorded.
Oh, well, that's a great compliment. Forget it.
I just feel as though we were sitting here chatting.
We are. So say whatever you want. We have no sponsors, you know. You can say whatever you want on this show. I told Mary Margaret McBride she said the reason that she doesn't go on television is that people, when she comes in the studio, say, oh, she looks not looking well today. Or the director will come over and tell her she'll have to lose a little weight. Or she has to have some bluing put in her hair. And she says, I'm too old for that. I can't be bothered. And I said, this is a no-girdle show. You just kick off your shoes and say and whatever you please and look any way you please. However,
have you ever had any repercussions from anything that's been said on your show?
No, I haven't. I've really had no letters of complaint.
That's good.
At all. I haven't at all. And as you know, as I told you before we began the broadcast, there's no restrictions of any kind. We can talk about anything we please.
You know, there was the... We depicted rural characters, and not barefooted characters, but small town characters. And we were a little concerned in the beginning that we might offend some of rural people. But it developed that our rural audience was our biggest audience. And we never had one letter of complaint or criticism about that.
In all those years on the network, and you never had a letter of complaint about that?
That's right.
I wonder how that speaks for the audiences of today. Because I know, having worked in television and radio, it's amazing what you have to go through in looking over scripts and developing characters to make sure you think they were running for office. They offend no one, as William Buckley always said. You mustn't offend anyone. But it really has gotten to the point, you know, you're paranoic, really, when you're developing a character.
That's right. I don't dare do this or don't dare do that. I think maybe the American public has been taught to be overly sensitive about such things.
Well, I'd like to think they were taught it and it didn't, you know, just come up on... in their own mind, because I think it's a national sickness today. I know that, we'll get some letters on this. I said I didn't get any, but I'll guess we will on this, what I'm going to say. I noticed that quite recently, within the last few months, the Amos and Andy show, which are played by Negroes, as a matter of fact, on television, was taken off of a Chicago channel because of complaints by Negro associations. Which is, to me, I just don't understand it.
I don't either, because actually that show, and it was a classic and one of the all-time greats on radio, depicted the Negro in a humorous, but certainly not belittling light.
Well, I never
they
felt...
They were lovable characters.
Well, I never felt that about J. Carroll Nash, who played Life with Luigi. And I don't think it's
Molly
because
of Goldberg.
No. Now, a lot of people say, well, we're not Negro and we're not Italian and we're not Jewish, but my goodness, I wouldn't be offended if they had a Polish character.
Well, I'm a country boy myself. I was never offended by rural jokes. As a matter of fact, I always thought they were talking about the other fellow, not me.
Well, oh, yeah. That's very interesting. Well, we're just thick-skinned, but I think it's true. It's become a national obsession. Oh, I did. As a matter of fact, I did get one letter asking me why I haven't had any Negroes on the program. And I thought it was a joke, but I called the woman, and it wasn't. It wasn't. I thought, you know, someone has written this. They think it's funny. I do a program called Whatever Happened To, and it's about celebrities from the past. And she writes me a nasty letter saying, why haven't I had any Negroes on the program? Well, I said, who did you have in mind? And she named a few, and I said, well, I have invited... She named three. And I had invited two of the three, and the other person, as it happened, was dead. And I said, now, what do you want me to do? You know, another person wrote in a very nice letter and said, why don't you have politicians? Because I promised when I began the series I would have politicians. And I said, until recently, it's very difficult to get politicians because they're either in office or they passed away. Now, I did get Hamilton Fish quite recently, and I was pleased for that. But there aren't that many. As a matter of fact, Mr. Fish and I discussed that on the program. We could only think of four living politicians who were big names in the 1920s and 1930s.
In other words, when you say whatever happened to such and such a politician, he's still in office.
Most of them are. We could only think of Martin Dies, Burton K. Wheeler, Gerald Nye, and Mr. Garner, but he's far too old, and only Mr. Fish was here in New York. And the others, I had invited each one of them. And they said if and when they came to New York, they would be on the program. But I had asked Ethel Waters on the program, but she's in California. Now, I do remote, but, you know, that's ridiculous. I can't go to California. I don't have a budget like that. But the woman was quite serious. As a matter of fact, she was white. Why didn't I have Negroes? When Cliff Arquette was on your program, this will change the tape. Who did he play?
He played Cliff Arquette. We called him by his real name. Now, he developed the character of Charlie Weaver later. We had known Cliff for a number of years, and he's a great performer.
He was always very funny. I asked Connie Boswell was telling that she had worked in the early 30s, something like 32, some of the first broadcasts that she and Martha and Yvette Boswell did from California. She said Cliff Arquette was on the show. And I was amazed. I didn't realize he went back
that far. Oh, he must be 100 years old, that fellow.
Well, he'll like that. I don't know if we've heard of Gettysburg.
I hope he's listening.
Isn't that where he lives, Gettysburg? Well, how long were you on the network? Networks, I should say. You were on what?
Well, we had a fast start. We only did five local shows in Hot Springs and then went with NBC. And over a period of years, we've been on all of the networks.
I must ask you to identify your color. What color was your hat?
Oh, well, we started on NBC Red and Blue.
Oh, both.
Quaker Oats was our first sponsor, and we did the show simultaneously on both networks.
I remember you long about the dinner hour on WXYZ, which was the ABC outlet in Detroit. So then you went to ABC or Blue. I guess it wasn't Blue then, it was just ABC.
Well, see, NBC was asked by the antitrust department, I suppose, to dispose of either the Red or the Blue network, and they chose to keep the Red network, and the other became the Blue network, then became ABC.
Well, that makes three networks you were on, because you also had a CBS show.
That's right, and we're also on Mutual. As a matter of fact, our show was the first program Mutual Network had. We were the only show they had for quite a number of weeks.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was just four stations hooked up, WOR, WLW, WXYZ, and WGN in Chicago. And then they started adding other stations throughout the country, and later it became the largest network of all in number of stations.
I didn't realize you were on all four networks. That must be a first, too. I don't recall any other show that was on all four.
I really don't know. It's possible.
They stuck with the networks in those days. You know, when one show moved from one network to the other, that network rating that they did in the late 40s, that was a big thing. I mean, Jack Benny was on it. What was it, 7 o'clock on Sunday night? It was on NBC, and that was it. It was just like FDR was president.
Well, then CBS went out and bought a lot of those shows, you know.
Yes. That was sort of the late 40s, though, when that big network radio, because CBS developed some of their own. Well, anyway. One of the movies that we mentioned you made was made in Yugoslavia.
Yeah, of all places.
Lum and Abner in Yugoslavia.
Can you imagine that? I don't know. I expect they're still shaking their heads trying to figure out what we were talking about.
I wondered that at the time because, what did they dub in the extras or were there any players from Yugoslavia in the movie?
Yeah, we had found a few actors over there that spoke English, but so with such an accent that it's hardly understandable over in this country.
Certainly not in Pine Ridge. I wonder what they did make of it. you know, from Yugoslavia.
Someday I hope to find out whether they played it all through Yugoslavia. They kept the Yugoslavian rights to the picture, and I'm sure it was played over there.
You don't know what the box office receipt that the Zagreb Bijou was?
I don't know what the reaction was either. We may be very large in Yugoslavia.
You might be. You might be a smash in Krakow or behind the Iron Curtain. Isn't that wild? You were also a first, that I recall, on radio to have a marathon. Or did they call them radiothons?
Well, no, we call it a marathon. I don't know how we cooked up that idea, but we got a lot of the stars in Hollywood to help us. We were in Hollywood at the time, living there. And we did a show for charity that lasted 12 hours. It was wonderful, the response that we had from the stars, radio and picture stars. We just sent them a wire, and I think with maybe two or three exceptions, they all responded, came down and made their appearance.
You were on for 12 hours?
12 hours.
Did you get whatever the goal was, or was there a
well,
goal?
Well, yes, it was very successful. It was something new and different, and we had, of course, a lot of the pledges that were made, called in and wired in from all over the United States, a lot of them were never collected.
Well, I have worked on telethons in Los Angeles. And that was the first thing you learned, to never, in matter of fact, as I recall, they didn't give the true total on the air. It was always down like a third of what they had contributed, because so many people, this is a sad comment on people, I think, would have a few drinks and call in something that they had no intention, or maybe they did have an intention of contributing, but they didn't send it in.
You don't want to hear their name called out.
And you can't, you know, go back the next night and say, by the way, when we mentioned your partner, Mr. Goff, did I say that you were Lum and that he was Abner? Because a lot of people might be confused.
I don't know when we did establish that or not.
I'm talking to Lum, and we were speaking a minute ago of Abner, who is in Palm Desert playing golf.
I'm sure he is right at this moment.
That will surprise a number of people, because he's been reported passed away on more than one occasion, as I remember.
Yeah, when Lou Costello died, the report came out that Abner died. Norris Goff.
How did you feel when
Bob Burns died? The same thing. When Babe Hardy died, Laurel Hardy, every time a member of a team dies, they always report that Norris Goff died. Of course, he hears these reports, too, and he made the, borrowed the old line from Mark Twain, the story of my death was greatly exaggerated, only he changed it a little. He said the story of my death was slightly exaggerated.
It must give you a start, you know, to hear your own death.
They've never tried to kill me off. They've tried to kill him off on four different occasions.
Well, they say that's good luck. Well, you heard that, to be reported dead, it means an extra, what, 7 years or something for your life?
He ought to live a
rightful
age.
He's got 28 years off on him.
If you can add 28 to a regular life expectancy, he's going to be an old man.
Do you ever miss it, radio?
No, not really. I love radio, and I think I really enjoyed writing the script as much as anything else. Just knowing that these characters are yours, you make them do anything you want to, make them stand on their heads, or make them good or bad.
I think that's interesting what you just said about being excited and pleased that you could make the characters do whatever you wanted them to do and develop them however you wanted them to develop, because you were writing the script. Now, that is something that's nearly non-existent, as you know, in television.
Well, I guess the performers in television really don't have the time for it. You see, a radio show like ours, of course, required very little rehearsal. We just read it to time it, was all, and since we had written it. Now, when we started making pictures, I must add, we had to get writers, because there wasn't enough hours in the day to write the script. We work with our writers, but they put it down on paper. But for 15 or more years, we wrote the script ourselves.
Do you listen to radio?
Not as much as I would like to. Actually, I'm a television fan. But I still think radio has a lot to offer that television can't possibly give us. A program like ours or a dramatic show, I think you can visualize a thing much and get a more vivid picture than you can by actually watching it on television.
Well, you say it has more to offer. I think the potential is there. It has more to offer. It could have more to offer. I don't think...
I think reading a book, you get a more of a vivid impression than you do of seeing that same story on the screen. And this is true with radio and television. I think you get a more vivid picture exercising your own imagination listening to radio than you do by sitting and watching it on television.
Well, I agree with you, but as I say, only theoretically, because the radio today, there is no program that I can think of. Or that
Talking about radio as it was years ago.
I thought you were, because there's nothing around today but the top 20 and some all-night talk shows, which maybe are a step in the right direction. I think that, for instance, when radio began as a commercial medium, for all intents and purposes in the early 30s, a lot of people who became great successes, such as you and your partner, were unheard of. New, raw talent. And someday, whether it be Bill Paley or General Sarnoff, whoever was running things at the network of those days, had enough guts and enthusiasm and imagination to take a chance, because they did. No one ever heard of Lum and After, or a lot of the people. Well, or Amos and Andy, for that matter. We could name any number of others. Now, the same situation developed for television, and people like Jackie Gleason and Sid Caesar and Jack Parr became the stars that they are. The same situation, I think, happened when radio was vacated by the people moving into television and people such as yourself retiring. And yet, it's never been taken up.
You know, it's amazing that how few people made the transition from radio to television.
True.
Many of them attempted it. Shows, as a show, I can't think of any that have survived. Personalities such as Red Skelton and Bob Hope and Jack Benny, a few of those have successfully switched to television. But I think that's because of their personality, not the show.
Well, then, too, I think most of those people were very well known in movies, visually. Bob Hope is certainly a big movie star. Jack Benny, I guess, was terribly unsuccessful, but he made a few movies. He was famous for his lack of success. I want to thank you very much for being here and wish you the same good luck I wish to your partner on his.
Thank you, Richard, and it's been a real pleasure being your guest.
Here are a few of the people who will be appearing on Whatever Happened To in future weeks. One of the big child stars of the 1930s in movies and on radio, Mr. Bobby Breen. Certainly one of the top torch singers of all time, Libby Holman. Larry Buster Crabb, known to anybody who's seen movies or, as a matter of fact, television. Two of the actors who are no longer children from the famous kiddie show Let's Pretend. The motion picture star of Silence and early talkies, she was most famous for the Todd Browning motion picture Freaks. Her name is Olga Baklanova. Several men who were part of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War will be here to discuss their part in that war. All of them will be heard on future broadcasts. Don't forget, if you're curious about anybody, whether they be a sports figure or a political personality or a theatrical or motion picture star, drop me a line to Richard Lamparski, that's spelled L-A-M-P-A-R-S-K-I, and I will be happy to let you know what they're doing and where they are. Next week, we'll find the answer to two questions. One is, can this little girl from a mining town of Silver Creek, Colorado, find happiness with England's richest and most handsome lord? The other question is, of course, whatever happened to our gal Sunday?